I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Officials in the U.S. and Europe say a terrorist plot to strike capital cities in Europe with Mumbai-style shooting sprees was in embryonic stages, but it was serious enough for the Eiffel Tower to be evacuated for the second time in 2 weeks yesterday. The details of the plot are reportedly coming from Ahmed Siddiqui, a German citizen of Afghan origin who was arrested in Kabul in July. And the news comes as newspapers in Europe are reporting that the radical Islamist group Siddiqui belonged to, the movement of Uzbekistan, is in Germany recruiting entire families to move to Pakistan to live in a village of white German converts training for jihad. Here's one of the group's videos. Obviously, we hear the word Mujahideen there. Joining us on the line from Washington is journalist and terrorism analyst Peter Bergen, a fellow with the New America Foundation. Peter, first of all, how serious is your take on this alleged plot?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of sort of smoke, and there appears to be some sort of fire, but a lot of things are not clear. One is, what was the target? If any, except a generalized thing that it might take place in Germany or France, and two, who is really involved, and we haven't really seen any evidence of particular people other than, again, generalized concerns about groups of individuals who've traveled to Pakistan's tribal areas. But, you know, I mean, certainly it's caused a ruckus in France and Germany, and to some degree the United States.
It certainly has. Well, we have heard of German connections to plots before. Siddiqui attended the same mosque in Hamburg where 9/11 attacker Mohammed Atta worshipped, and when Siddiqui was arrested over the summer, that mosque was shut down. One terrorism analyst told us that in 2009 alone, 40 Germans went to Waziristan in Pakistan. So who are they? Are they, as Siddiqui has said, white German families who might stick out in Pakistan but travel more freely throughout Europe? Do we know who they are?
Well, I actually think that they're not necessarily white Germans. I mean, some may be, but I mean, a lot of them are second-generation Turks who are, you know, have either German residency or citizenship and have gone to the tribal areas. You know, as you know, Germany has a significant Turkish community, and that's where some of these people are being recruited. They're being recruited, as you've said in the lead, into a group called Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, which is an Uzbek group that functions both in Uzbekistan, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. There's also a splinter group called the Islamic Jihad Union, which is similar in orientation. And that group actually planned to attack Ramstein Air Force Base, a major American facility in Germany, in 2007. They had assembled industrial amounts of hydrogen peroxide, which is sort of a signature of people who are trained in the tribal regions, very effective high explosive, if you know what you're doing, that was used in the London attacks of July 7th, 2005. So, you know, the fact that there is anxiety about this group is based on, you know, previous plots in Germany itself.
Well, and those arrests that you mentioned in Germany were around the same time that two American women were arrested. We remember Jihad Jane. Now, yesterday, a BBC reporter told us he thought the stepped-up drone strikes in Pakistan led by the U.S. might be connected to this terror alert in Europe. Today, a British official confirms that but takes it further, telling the AP that the strikes in Pakistan are actually thought to have disrupted this attack. Your thoughts on that?
Well, certainly, you know, September 2010 saw, we keep a database of these strikes at the New America Foundation, and there were 20 in September already. Mm. You know, if you compare that to the last year of the Bush administration, there were only 34. So this is, you know, the Obama administration has really ramped these strikes up. And clearly they've been ramped up in September as well. There could be lots of reasons for that, including trying to disrupt this plot, but also the effects of the flood have sort of receded, and some of the drones probably fly out of a base in the flood-affected area in Pakistan, so there was that suppressed the number of attacks for a little bit.
Yeah.
Also, a desire to go after the Akhani network, which is a sort of ferocious Taliban group based in North Waziristan, where all these strikes are being directed.
That's terrorism analyst Peter Bergen, a fellow with the New America Foundation, also author of The Osama Bin Laden I Know, an Oral History of Al-Qaeda's Leader. Peter, thanks as always.
Thanks a lot.
Well, the new Supreme Court term begins Monday with a new justice, Elena Kagan, on the bench for her first term. Yesterday, the court added 14 cases to the docket, including one that explores the rights of corporations to due process and privacy. That's going to be watched closely. It follows the court's controversial ruling earlier this year that corporations and unions have a First Amendment right to spend money on ads for candidates in elections. And as we've seen, that money has been flowing. But already on the docket before yesterday's additions, cases involving the free speech of those hateful military funeral protesters, a test of one of Arizona's immigration laws that regards employer responsibility, and a question of whether someone wrongly convicted of murder can recover damages. So let's get a preview today with Emily Bazelon. She's legal affairs editor for Slate and also editor of Slate's Double X blog for women's issues. And Emily joins us from the Yale University studios. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
And let's start with Elena Kagan, the former Harvard Law School dean, also President Obama's former Solicitor General. Because she was the president's lawyer, she's recusing herself from many of the cases the court will hear. Does she have to do that? And what will that mean, do you think, in the end result?
You know, recusal is sort of this murky ground. There are some cases in which, yes, she would have to do that if she had a financial interest in the case, for example. But these recusals, these decisions not to participate, aren't about that. They're about her previous involvement in the case as Solicitor General. Or in some cases, it's really kind of more distant than that. It's some sense that the Obama administration is involved. And I think Kagan has erred on the side of being very careful and in taking herself out of 21 of the 40 cases the court has agreed to argument in so far.
Well, and so to the second question, how do you think that's going to impact, you know, the overall season? Because, you know, in some cases, she might have been a deciding vote.
What it means is that the court can split 4-4, and if that happens, then the ruling of the lower court will stand. So in a case in which, you know, the defendant won in the lower court, the defendant will continue to win, and, you know, vice versa. It just all depends on the lower court ruling. It's a pretty unsatisfying ending for a visit to the Supreme Court, and it could really shape the way the term develops.
Right. And you've said it also means that Justice Kennedy's vote is now more important than ever.
That's right, because you have to win 5-3. And so you have to persuade Justice Kennedy, who's seen as the swing justice, and you have to do it without presumably one of the members of the liberal moderate bloc of the court.
Yeah. Well, let's get to some of the cases. One that jumps out at us in the first week is Snyder versus Phelps. This is Fred Phelps, pastor of the Westboro Baptist Church in Topeka, Kansas. Members of the church show up at funerals of American soldiers because Fred Phelps believes God is killing troops in Afghanistan and Iraq to punish the U.S. for tolerating homosexuality, even for don't ask, don't tell, which in his mind is toleration. So a father whose son was killed in Iraq has brought this case. Tell us more about it.
This is a really emotionally charged case. Al Snyder's son, Matthew Snyder, was killed in Iraq, and he wanted to have a funeral with privacy and decorum. So they came to this soldier's funeral with signs that said things including "Thank God for dead soldiers." And for Al Snyder, this was very upsetting. He did not want his son to be remembered with the distraction of this kind of protest, and so he sued for intentional infliction of emotional distress and won a very large $5 million damages verdict. That verdict was then struck down by the appeals court on free speech grounds.
So the court that overruled the decision felt that what Phelps' outrageous speech didn't reach the threshold of, you know, shouting fire in a crowded theater?
That's right. Shouting fire in a crowded theater is an incitement, is threat. And the kind of speech that was at issue here wasn't threatening directly. It was just repulsive to Mr. Snyder and to a lot of people. And we have a strong First Amendment principle in this country that however repugnant speech is, if it is simply expressing a political view, then we allow it.
Interesting to see where the court goes there. Another case you're looking at, Flores VR versus the U.S., a gender discrimination case that sort of collides with immigration.
This is a totally fascinating case in which a man named Ruben Flores Villar was born in Mexico, but at the age of 2 months, he moved to California. And he was raised there by his father and his grandmother, but he never became a citizen. So at some point, the United States moved to deport him. And at that point, he said, wait a second, I should be entitled to citizenship because if I had been raised by my mother, who was a U.S. citizen, I would be a citizen. And the reason for that is that the law affecting people in his position says that for the mother of this kind of child, you only need to show 1 year of residency as a U.S. citizen. But for the father, you need to show 5 years. And some of that time needs to be after the age of 14.
Wow, this gets complicated. So again, this has to do with children born out of the country, but coming to the country and raised by a parent. The court is saying that it's easier for a mother to confer citizenship on the child than a father?
Exactly. That's what matters here. And the rationale, this is a law that dates from 1940, was that the government was trying to protect statelessness in the children of unwed mothers. But the argument that Mr. Flores Villar is making now is that the same thing applies for fathers, and there's no reason to think that the children of unwed fathers who come to this country when they're young and don't have a citizen mother shouldn't be afforded the exact same legal protection.
And the court takes up this issue as people have all sorts of citizenship questions, so that'll be interesting to watch. Another case in the first week, Connick versus Thompson. This is a criminal justice case involving the withholding of evidence. Tell us about this.
This is the story of a man named John Thompson who spent 18 years in prison, 14 of them in solitary confinement, and then along the way discovered that he was in prison in part because of evidence that the prosecution had not turned over. There was a report about blood found at the scene of one of the crimes he was convicted of committing, and that blood did not belong to him. And once that report was divulged, the entire case against him unraveled. He was exonerated, and he won a large jury verdict against the prosecutor's office for this wrongful conviction. And the question in this case is whether you can hold a prosecutor's office liable in these kinds of circumstances, whether this prosecutor didn't train his office well enough to know how to turn over evidence the way they should have, and whether that gives John Thompson a right to recover.
Well, so distinguish this from other cases where people wrongfully convicted and on death row have received settlements.
The issue here is that the jury said that this prosecutor didn't train his lawyers well enough. He actually, when he testified, didn't really know the law for turning over what's called exculpatory evidence. He had brushed off a previous judgment against his office in which something similar had happened. And so that's the basis for the jury's ruling. And the question is whether that's enough or whether a defendant would have to show that the prosecutors deliberately didn't turn over evidence and didn't train their personnel, or whether there was a pattern of that kind of problem in the office.
Emily Bazelon, legal affairs editor for Slate.com. The docket this year includes cases involving free speech, disputes over consumer suits against automakers, and sanctions on employers for hiring illegal immigrants. The court will also consider the state's secrets privilege that allows the government to end litigation by invoking national security. Another case asks the justices to consider whether the government violated the privacy of federal workers by conducting background checks on whether they'd received treatment for drug use or had mental or financial problems. So there's all of that. But Emily Bazelon, we want to ask you about another criminal justice case that involves DNA evidence. This is Skinner versus Switzer. Tell us about that case.
This case is about whether there is a constitutional right to DNA testing. This man, Henry Skinner, is on death row in Texas. He has always maintained his innocence. And evidence has come to light that's quite troubling and suggests that he may, in fact, have a basis for saying that. Lots of the physical evidence at the scene of the crime was never tested for DNA, including a bloody knife, which was used for the murder that he was convicted of. And the state of Texas has refused to do this additional testing. So the question is whether Mr. Skinner has a right to that testing. And this is really a kind of last-ditch 11th-hour appeal to prevent his execution.
Okay. A couple cases in the state of California. One asks if a state can put limits on the content of violent video games. Is that constitutional? What are the arguments there?
Well, the argument here against this state law is that the First Amendment protects this kind of speech. But California is arguing that kids should be treated differently. They should be protected from violent video games in the same way they can be from obscene speech. And the Supreme Court has allowed in past context some rules that limit free speech when it comes to kids seeing speech that is viewed as obscene. And so the question is, can these violent video games be held to that same standard, and can the state prevent the sale and rental of them to kids under the age of 18?
Well, and the other one, quickly, in California, gets at the rights of prisoners in the overcrowded prisons in California.
This is a judgment that came out of California in a kind of desperate situation where the prisons have become so overcrowded that a 3-judge panel ruled that one inmate a week was actually dying. And finally, after protracted litigation, ordered the state to reduce its prison population by about 40,000 inmates in the next 2 years. And the question is whether this oversteps the bounds of judicial authority. Can courts make these kinds of demands on the state once you have amassed all this evidence of terrible and inhumane conditions in prisons?
Okay, so we'll watch that one. And one last one we want to just touch on, the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986. This is a law that prohibits certain claims against the makers of vaccines if someone is injured or even dies after a vaccine. The makers are protected. So what is the question here?
Well, what's going on in this case is this question of whether people can sue for a design defect in a vaccine if they think that design defect was a result of negligence on the part of the manufacturer. And just to back up a minute, the reason we have this act that limits these lawsuits is that vaccine makers, before we had it, started pulling out of making vaccines. It just became so expensive to defend against lawsuits because people tend to blame a lot of problems on vaccines, and juries are sometimes confused about whether the vaccines actually caused the injury. There was a lot of litigation. It was getting very expensive. And so we're supposed to have this kind of model court where if people think they've been injured by a vaccine, they can go to a special court. They can get some kind of relief, but not a huge money damage that would put a vaccine maker out of business. And in this particular case, this was a shot for DPT, diphtheria, and a couple of other illnesses, and a child who at the age of 6 months started having seizures right after she received the vaccines. Her parents say that this vaccine wasn't made in the right way, and the manufacturer by this point should have known that there was this design defect. And the question is whether they can bring a civil lawsuit for that kind of claim.
Okay. Well, Emily, just a minute or so on the bigger picture. As we said, Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, the two newest justices on the court. It is the Roberts Court. But at what juncture? What kind of court do you think we're looking at?
We saw a pretty bold and aggressive Roberts Court last term and the term before, where the conservative majority of 5 was really asserting itself in some big rulings, especially the campaign finance ruling last year. And the question is whether the arrival of Justice Kagan will somehow shift that dynamic. Sometimes the interpersonal dynamic on the court has its whole own effect and own reality to it. And so in that sense, every single seat and particular personality matters. So that will be really interesting to watch as the year unfolds.
And do you think we're seeing the exit of any other justices?
We haven't had any indication that any of them plan to leave. There's always some gossip that someone is out the door, but I expect not. I think we will have a year or two of this particular composition of the court to watch it.
That's Emily Bazelon. She's legal affairs editor for Slate, but also the Truman Capote Law and Media Fellow at Yale Law School. Emily, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we take a break, here's a brief update on musician Justin Townes Earle, son of Steve Earle. We spoke recently with Justin about his new CD, Harlem River Blues. Now, his substance abuse problems are well known, and he told us then that sometimes music helps.
You know, music has been the only thing that that's ever been consistent in my life. It's the only thing I've ever had constant. It's the only thing that's ever been there that I could count on to be there. And so I hold on to it very tightly.
Well, I'm just a lonely traveler and I don't know where I'm bound. But if I keep moving, then I know that I'll be found. I'll climb high atop a mountain, call for he who holds the crown. But until that day, keep on wondering
Well, apparently the music wasn't enough. Since we spoke, Justin has canceled the rest of his tour and entered rehab after an altercation with a nightclub owner in Indianapolis. On his website, he thanks his family, friends, and fans for their continued support through a difficult time. Still ahead today, Joe Biden front and center. The latest news is next, here and now.
Well, now in this world of wonders, there are things a man must see. There are trials he must know, and there are troubles he must meet. He must stare in the eyes of evil, know that he is free. Till the good Lord calls, keep on wandering.
We have an update on a story we brought you yesterday. Remember, we spoke with the U.S. Attorney for Rhode Island about the dangers of laser pointers aimed at aircraft taking off or landing in airports. 1,700 incidents in the last 8 months. Well, a lot of you wrote in wondering whether those pointers could actually serve the purpose some of the laser users said they were using it for, namely stargazing and pointing out constellations. I mean, those stars are a long ways away. Joseph Bellino wrote on his iPhone, these lasers are pointers for lectures. They're not used for astronomy, as suggested. There's no reason to have one on a beach but mischief. And Wendell Burton wrote from Advance, North Carolina, that he's in the construction trade, and lasers are often used in the construction trade. They're an indispensable tool. But he writes, even from my experience, the most expensive ones are only accurate and visible up to several hundred feet. None of the ones we use would be able to pinpoint a moving aircraft as far away as 700 feet. Is there more to this story? Well, if there is, we are sure to get it from our resident stargazer, Kelly Beatty of Sky and Telescope magazine. Kelly?
Yes?
Do people use these laser pointers on the beach to sort of point out stars and constellations?
Absolutely. A green-colored laser light is becoming an indispensable tool at star parties.
But how does that work? Because it's not as if the green dot is going to land on the star light years away.
Right. So this is an intense little beam of light, and we don't realize it, but there are little particles in the air, aerosols, bits of dust, pollen, even droplets of water vapor. And as the laser's light goes through the atmosphere, it scatters light off of those little particles that are along its path. So we actually see the path in the night sky as a line leading up to the stars, kind of like Luke Skywalker's lightsaber.
Mm-hmm.
And so by pointing a laser toward a star, we literally see a line of light pointing in the direction of the star, not only for the person with the laser, but anybody who happens to be standing nearby. It's become a lot easier to point things out in the night sky using these things.
Well, but you're hearing the correlating problem. I mean, people are shining them on blimps, on airplanes as they land, on helicopters. Now, some of this could be, I'm thinking, that these helicopters and airplanes are maybe crossing in the line of the laser. But what, you know, are you people in the business concerned?
Absolutely, for a couple of reasons. First of all, we're responsible users. I won't say that there isn't some maverick out there who's doing it, but we know the dangers of using these things. And when I use these at star parties, anytime there's an airplane anywhere near the area, I stop using it. The greater concern is that if these were to somehow become restricted for use, the federal government were to step in and say, you know, no green lasers can be sold or used, it would really crimp our style. And so I'm worried that some of these yahoos are out there doing the kinds of things that you've been reporting on are really spoiling it for those of us who have legitimate reasons to be using them.
Well, first of all, I made a note here. I've never been invited to one of your star parties, Kelly. But hang on. When we talked to the officials from Rhode Island, they said that, you know, maybe just limiting the use. So, for instance, not to be able to use it within, several hundred feet of an airport, for instance. Would you agree that that might be a good recommendation?
Well, remember that up here in Boston, as opposed to Rhode Island, I mean, the glide path for these airliners is, you know, tens of miles long. And these lasers we're talking about are incredibly powerful, much more so than were available just 5 years ago. So literally you can shine a light on a pilot if you're careful enough. And I'm not supposing that anyone would do this, but miles away. And so that's the danger. The light spreads out over distance and actually makes a beam big enough to illuminate an entire cockpit.
Well, something tells me that there's got to be, and maybe you agree, something that happens so that you, a stargazer, are able to use it, but a nefarious person is not.
Well, I think that what needs to be recognized is that stargazers have a legitimate need for it, and that's not to say that the policeman won't come by and say, hey, what the heck are you doing with that, and we'll need to explain ourselves away. I'm not sure we need a registration card, but certainly we need to get the word out that there are good uses for these things and that there are people using them responsibly.
Kelly Beattie, stargazer, senior editor for Sky and Telescope magazine, friend of Here and Now. Kelly, thanks as always.
All right, Robin, you'll get that invitation soon.
Okay, thank you. Quick break, back in 30 seconds, Here and Now. Vice President Joe Biden is front and center again as the White House kicks into campaign gear ahead of the midterm elections. Biden echoing President Obama's call to Democrats to buck up and going a bit further during a private fundraiser in New Hampshire, telling them to stop whining. Before that, on Rachel Maddow's show on MSNBC, Biden had this message for his party and for progressives who aren't happy with the Obama administration these days.
You know, get in gear, man. First of all, there's a great deal at stake. I've been around the Senate a long time. We fought to regulate tobacco. We fought for hate crime laws. We fought to make sure that kids get insured. We fought for all the things that we finally got done in 1 year. And they're all at risk.
Playing cheerleader for the Obama administration is a role that fits Joe Biden well, as a new profile in The Atlantic magazine reminds us. It also reminds us of his personal tragedy and political setbacks, his first wife and baby daughter killed in a horrible car accident that also badly injured his two sons back in 1972, just after he was elected to the Senate, and Biden himself almost dying from a brain aneurysm in 1988 after his first unsuccessful run for president. Well, Black Hawk Down author Mark Bowden has written the story. You can read it at hearandnow.org, but let's check in with Mark for more. Mark, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you, Robin.
And the headline is, "The Salesman." You remind us Joe Biden is the son of a car salesman, and he demonstrates he's a salesman himself in one of his favorite expressions.
Here's the deal.
Give us a sense. How does he use it?
Joe is always making deals, and if he's explaining policy to you, if he's selling himself or Obama or a piece of legislation to you, he's always trying to boil things down to a simple equation that everyone can grasp. He's always, in his own mind, checking himself when he wanders a little too far off into bureaucratic talk or the details of policy, trying to communicate very directly. So he distills things, and he will say, here's the deal.
And then spit it out. And as he does so, he'll be right in your face, in your space, very physical as well. So if he's such a good salesman, why wasn't he able to sell his point of view on the war in Afghanistan? We see details of that argument in the new Bob Woodward book, but also before that from the Rolling Stone piece about General Stanley McChrystal, McChrystal and his aides deriding Biden, Biden being the one who was against the surge, opposed to escalating the war. Why didn't he win that argument?
Well, I think Biden was asked to play, and it suited him because I think he completely agreed with it, a role in that process, and he played it very aggressively. But I think his point of view, which was to hasten America's withdrawal from Afghanistan, was a minority viewpoint going in, considering the people arrayed around the table, the State Department with Hillary Clinton, the Defense Department with Robert Gates, with David Petraeus, and the National Security Council head. None of these people were about to embrace a policy that called for the United States to rapidly withdraw. And so, you know, but Biden, I think, you know, was encouraged to and played a very strong role in that debate, enforcing those who were advocating for expansion of America's role there or some longer-term commitment to reexamine their own premises. And it enabled Obama, I think, to listen to this debate and have it aired in a candid and, in other words, to consider all points of view without right. having himself weighed in with the decision until it was time.
Well, and he told you that he was flattered by General McChrystal's comments in the magazine. It sort of gave him a, you know, some sort of stature. But what is his role? I mean, because he had that minority view, was he sidelined? We don't feel we've seen Joe Biden.
Joe Biden, I don't think, has been sidelined at all. He's very much a part of all of the discussions in the White House. I think he'd be the first to tell you that he doesn't always win his arguments and he doesn't always persuade the president of his point of view, but he is one of the key people whose viewpoint is being considered. And I think if we go back to the Afghanistan issue, I mean, you say that he didn't prevail in those discussions and that Obama did agree to commit more troops to Afghanistan. He did prevail in the sense that the president has been adamant about a timeline that begins American withdrawal next summer. And I think as this process unfolds, you may see that ultimately Biden's point of view prevails.
Well, and you know, vice presidents are notoriously second bananas, with the exception recently of Dick Cheney. Now, you write that Joe Biden made a big deal of saying he didn't want to do what Cheney did, which in Biden's words was in effect creating a shadow national security staff. And so Biden, when he came in, turned down staffers to make this big contrast between him and Cheney. But there was a little hyperbole there.
Well, as with most things, Joe tends to get carried away in his arguments, and it pays to go back and double-check on the specifics of what he tells you. He has, a tendency that is just a big, basic part of his personality to exaggerate points in an argument to his own benefit. Turns out he didn't turn over anywhere near as many staffers as he claimed, and at least in his conversation with me. But what he has done, I think, is to a degree that Cheney did not, is make it clear that President Obama is in charge and that he is a member of the team. He is not a sort of a separate fiefdom inside the White House advocating for a different set of policies or a different point of view.
Yeah. What do you think his impact will be on the road now as the Democrats, you know, are looking at a very tough midterm election?
My assessment of it is that he will play an increasingly important role because I think that, Obama's administration is strong with more intellectual, educated folks. It's the mainstream blue-collar voters who respond more with their gut than with their brains in following candidates. I think that Biden speaks to those voters much more powerfully and directly than Obama does. And, you know, the Democratic Party has a very strong blue-collar base, and even though we hear a lot from the opposition and those who are, adamantly opposed to the way that this administration has attempted to use government, there is, I think, a very strong constituency for the things that Obama has been trying to do. He himself, I think the president, has done a subpar job in rallying his own natural supporters and in, building that constituency. But I think Biden is more gifted at doing that. It comes more naturally to him.
Mark Bowden, his profile of Vice President Joe Biden appears in the October issue of The Atlantic. And again, you can read it at hereandnow.org. Mark, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin. My pleasure.
Phil Collins. I mean, what more do we have to say? Grammy and Oscar winner, sold over 100 million records, lead singer and drummer for the mega group Genesis.
Yeah, there's no reply at all. There's no reply at all.
Solo artist.
I can feel it coming in the air tonight.
And then his fans became parents, and he sang for their children as well. Well, now Phil Collins is going back to his own childhood. Going Back is the title of his new CD. On it, the songs he listened to, including a lot of Motown.
Papa was a rolling stone. Wherever he laid his hat was his home. When he died, all he left was alone.
Phil Collins' take on the Temptations, Papa was a Rolling Stone. We caught up with him yesterday. Now, he was waiting in the studios of WNYC in New York, drumming his fingers. But, of course, these were Phil Collins' fingers. Phil Collins?
Yes.
Are you drumming?
I'm tapping.
You are tapping. We were sitting here thrilled.
Ah. I don't know, how long have you been listening to me tap?
Just a couple seconds now, but can I just ask you about that? Because, yeah, we thought your hands had had some kind of neurological damage. But yeah, you can tap.
I'm not completely immobile, you know, like they're wheeling me in and out of places. No, I can still tap, although I may be tapping more with my right hand than I used to.
Well, and did I understand that you had to actually tape the sticks on this new CD to your hands?
Yeah, gaffer taped them to my left hand anyway. Yeah, that was a little frustrating.
Yeah.
But I was kind of expecting it because I'd been living with this problem for about 2 years. It was just nerves that had been pulled out of place.
Wow.
Because of something had happened. I'm not quite sure what.
Well, I'm just the image of you with your drumsticks taped to your hands, you know, it might have been difficult if you forgot they were.
Yeah, well, I had to make the decision as to whether to, you know, after we've done a take. Normally, you just put the sticks down and go and listen to it and put them back up and then do it again if you want to do it.
Yeah.
But when they're taped to your arm, it was a bit of a long-winded process. So I used to walk around with this one stick in my hand as a warning to others.
I have a stick. Yeah. Well, let's talk about the new CD. And here you are growing all, you know, Rod Stewart and Michael McDonald on us. recording songs from the 60s. Why? What does that music do for you?
Well, it was the album I always wanted to make, really. It was the soundtrack to my teenage years. I'd go and listen to bands in clubs and hear those songs, and I'd make notes of the titles, and I'd go out the next day and go to a record shop and buy them. You know, it became the songs that you hear on the record are actually a distilled list of what I was listening to at the time.
Oh, sure, it would have to be, yeah. Mm. Well, and so we heard a song like the Supremes, Love Is Here, Now You're Gone. It's a Holland Dozier Holland hit.
Love is here, and oh my darling, now you're gone.
Lamont Dozier, didn't you write Two Hearts with him?
Yeah, well, I met him actually in 1985. He came to a show of mine, and for me, it was like meeting, you know, my history. I mean, it was like suddenly he wanted to meet me, and I just didn't want to talk about me. I wanted to talk about him, you know.
Right.
It was a big thrill to meet him. And eventually, when I did the movie Buster, I suggested him to write the music because him and the two Holland brothers basically... Mm. You know, if you weren't Lennon McCartney, you were Holland Dozier Holland. You had the fingerprint of the 60s.
A lot of songs on the CD, people say, oh my gosh, it's like a number one hit. It'll instantly throw them back. But then there are a couple from Stevie Wonder that were sort of, you know, the albums that you listened to, including Never Dreamed You'd Leave in Summer. Let's listen.
I never dreamed you'd leave in summer. I thought you would go, then come back home.
Such a killer. Is that a song where you say, damn, I wish I'd written that?
Yeah, most of these are like that. You know, I came across this song a few years ago, actually, and coincidentally, he sang it at Michael Jackson's funeral, Stevie Wonder did. But it is just hidden on the back side of one of his singles. You know, I mean, his work is extraordinary.
A lot of girl bands on the new CD. Were you, like, singing these songs into your hairbrush when you were... A kid?
Well, Martha and the Vandellas, you know, particularly, they had some fantastic songs, you know. I mean, they're a bit underrated, Martha and the Vandellas. They had, you know, the Dancing in the Street, the Heatwave, Jimmy Mac. It could be argued they may have had stronger rhythm and blues songs than the Supremes. I think I'm singing better now than I ever have done, actually, which is kind of ironic because I'm really kind of drawing the curtain down on my professional career a bit.
Well, hold on a second, because we want to talk about that. Your voice sounds spectacular, but you have been talking about drawing this curtain down, you know, not writing anymore?
Well, no, I think probably what will happen... See, normally the sort of what happened, the procedure... The procedure laid down by the Songwriters Guild is that you write songs, you write some songs, and then you record them and then you put them out as a record and tell everybody how great they are. I have a little bit of trouble with the last part of that. I think the enjoyment for me comes from writing and also comes from sitting in my little room, in my studio where I work on my own. And, you know, in a way, kind of paint the picture, you know. What happens to it after that? If you go on tour, you end up in hotels for a good long time, playing every night, and then you miss so much with the kids.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, I think I'm just trying to slam on the brakes.
Well, and that may be reflected a little in the last song on the CD. It was originally recorded by the late, great Dusty Springfield, written by Carole King and Jerry Goffin. It's Going Back.
I think I'm going back to the thing I learned so well in my youth. I think I'm returning to all those days when I was young enough to know the truth.
Is it some of that sort of like, you know, there's an introspective moment or?
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, as things start to wear out, you know, like your hand.
God, I said that we're burying you. You're only 60. You're 60. That's young.
I know. And that's why I want to enjoy life with my kids, you know, while I still can. But
you're reminding me of that character, the Monty Python character, you know, with all the parts falling off.
Yes, it's only a flesh wound. I will do something, you know, but I know that if I actually keep the door open full, as it has been for the last 40-odd years, I know that I'll get busy and I'll get taken away. And then, I've got 5 kids from 3 marriages. I don't live with any of them. So my life is very complicated. Yeah. And, it would be nice to spend more time with my family.
That's Grammy and Oscar award-winning singer-songwriter Phil Collins, his latest CD, Going Back, covers of the songs he loved. Phil, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.